But God found fault with the people and said, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is a covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." By calling this covenant new, he has made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete is aging and will soon disappear. Covenant. It's not a word all of us use. Most of us probably know what it means. Some of us may not be. You probably don't discuss covenants on your cornflakes in the morning, or your Red River cereal, or whatever it is you have. What is a covenant? It's kind of binding, very strong, very special agreement between two parties. Like marriage is a covenant, or it used to be, when two people promised that they would live together until death separated them. It was a covenant. And the Hebrews had a covenant between themselves and God. They were his chosen people. And they were in this special relationship with him. And they didn't want to lose it. And they criticized the Christians for saying that they could leave that and become Christians and turn to Christ. And they said, "But what about this agreement we have?" Well, says the writer to the Hebrews, it's an old one, it's an obsolete one, and there is a new one. And you should have expected a new one, because about 600 years ago, Jeremiah told you there would be one. About 600 years before Christ, Jeremiah, in chapter 31 of his prophecy, wrote the words that have been recorded here for us again in Hebrews about a new covenant. Well, if there was an old covenant, there must have been something wrong with it for the need to be a new covenant. What was wrong with it? Well, when was the old covenant set up? God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt. Broke the power of the Egyptians, brought them out, brought them to Sinai. Sinai, mountain about 6,000 feet high. Their leader Moses was 80 years old. And he gave the people 2 days. During those 2 days, they were to set barricades all the way around the base of the mountain. And the other thing they were to do was to wash their clothes. 2 days to wash their clothes. Sounds like a long time. It's not because they had a lot of clothes, nor because they were particularly dirty, nor even because they were particularly slow at washing their clothes. Rather, it was because they were to prepare themselves mentally and emotionally and spiritually in order not to go on the mountain. Because they weren't going to be allowed on the mountain. That's why they were setting barricades around the base. And God said to them, nobody is to cross the barricades and set foot on the mountain. If anybody does, child, man, woman, animal even, they're to be stoned to death immediately. If you don't observe that, then I will break out in fiery judgment amongst all of you. I'm a holy God. I'm not easily approached by sinful people. Set barricades around the base of the mountain and spend 2 days getting yourselves prepared in order not to go on the mountain. That idea is a little foreign to us. We like to think we can just bust into the presence of God or anybody else any time. As we saw this morning, from the trappings of the tabernacle, etc., it's very difficult to get a sinful, guilty man, afraid because he's broken God's law, into the presence of a holy, righteous, and just God. Very difficult. And so God covered the mountain with a dense cloud. There was a great trumpet blast and earthquake, and God came down on top of the mountain. Why the dense cloud? Is God shy or something? Does he think that if we saw him, we'd be kind of disappointed, be an anticlimax, and what's all the fuss about? No way. You may have heard people talk about God like this. What's so special about God anyway? Why should I believe in God? If I've got to believe in God and it's all that important, why doesn't he come here and show himself? They want to be glad he doesn't. We had an eclipse not long ago. We're warned not to look at it. Even though nearly all the sun was going to be covered up with a shadow of the moon, and we were not to look at it. Why? Because we'd lose our eyesight. Nearly all of it covered up with the moon, only a little fraction exposed, 93 million miles away, light spreading out over 93 million miles, not very much gets to us, filtered by our rather thick, heavy, polluted atmosphere, ozone layer, what's left of it, and all the rest. And what gets through to you is enough to make you lose your eyesight. Would you like to see the sun from close too? Without a filter? So why would you like to see the creator of that sun and all the others? God doesn't veil himself because he is shy, just because we couldn't survive the revelation. So is a dense cloud on the mountain. Moses is summoned up the mountain. He's 80 years old and goes up the mountain, 6,000 feet. Are you going to go mountaineering when you're 80? Since your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, it's not a bad idea to look after it. You never know what you might be called upon to do. Moses arrived 80 years old on top of a 6,000 foot mountain, panting slightly, and do you know what God said to him? Moses, go back down again. He did. Moses, you go right back down again. Go all the way around the base of the mountain, check out the barricades, warn the people, tell them I'm not playing games, I mean it, they're not to cross those barricades, otherwise there's judgment. And Moses, without even a whisper of an argument, went all the way back down again, right around the base of the mountain, and 6,000 feet back to the top to meet with God. And the old covenant was set up between God and his people. And these terms, he said, I am the God who rescued you from the land of Egypt. Now this is what you're going to do for me. And he gave them the laws. Good laws, every last one of them. Every law was a good law. Because every law, really, was just the character of God spelt out in terms of human behavior. See, God is faithful. We read that this morning. There isn't time to talk about it. But since God is faithful, if he was a man, he would not be an adulterer. So the law says, thou shalt not commit adultery. What's wrong with adultery? It's enjoyable, they tell me. Everybody's doing it, they tell me, whoever everybody is. I'm not part of it, but apparently everybody's doing it. If it's enjoyable and everyone's doing it, what's wrong with it? It's not like God. He's not like that. He's faithful. And since you and I are supposed to be in the image of God, and God doesn't change and he's not an adulterer, adultery will never be right, never be good. However popular it may become and however pleasant it may be. God is God of integrity. If he's a man, he wouldn't be a thief. So the law says, thou shalt not steal. What's wrong with stealing? If you're hungry and you need the money, the other guy's got too much anyway. Maybe you'll never find out. Steal from the government, they'll never know. By the time they sort their computers out, you'll have been dead for years. Why not? They've got plenty, haven't they? God isn't a thief. Don't you be a thief. You're supposed to be like him. And every law that God gave was a good law, and there wasn't a bad one among them. But there are always problems when we try to live according to the law. See, confronted with a set of laws, every one of us will have some that we like and agree with, and one or two that we don't really agree with. And we'll forget the one or two that we don't really agree with, as long as we can get away with forgetting them, and we'll keep the others. And that always gets us in trouble. It's discouraging. And there'll be one or two others, and we do agree with them. The trouble is we can't keep them. We'd like to, but we can't. And so we break them, either because we can't keep them or because we don't want to keep them. And then it becomes very discouraging. There's a nice couple over here offered to give me a ride into Scarborough on Saturday. They don't know it yet, but it might just be that they'll let me drive. So we drive into Scarborough through Toronto at 125 miles an hour. And the police stop us. And they say to me, since I'm behind the wheel, "You are driving at 125 miles an hour." And I say, "Yeah, isn't it fun?" And they say, "Yeah, but it's against the law." I say, "Oh. Was I driving on the left or the right?" "You were driving on the right." "Well, isn't that nice of me?" See, because everybody knows that the correct side to drive on is the left, the way we do it in Great Britain. Just to suit you strange people over here, I drive on the right. Now, isn't that nice? Not at 125 miles an hour. Just a minute. Did I knock down any old ladies? No, you didn't, but 120... Hold it. Did I knock down any young ladies? No, you didn't, but 100... Just a minute. Did I run through any red traffic lights? No, you didn't, but... Hang on. Why must you be so picky? Why must you keep on harking back to this one miserable little law that I happen to have broken when there are all these over here that I've kept? Why can't you say thank you to me for keeping those and forget that one? Now, is that the way the law works? Did you ever have a policeman stop you and say, "Excuse me, I want to say thank you to you for keeping the speed limit today"? No, all the law ever does is condemn you. If there are 1,000 laws and you break one and keep 999, it doesn't congratulate you for keeping 999. It just condemns you for breaking the one. Doesn't it? That's why it's never encouraging to try and please God on the basis of keeping the law. It's always discouraging. And since we don't really like being discouraged, and we don't really like living with guilt, it's much easier to forget the law. So that's what they did. They even lost it. Didn't know where it was. Stayed lost for years. Got very upset when they found it again. Josiah's time. Oops, look what we've been doing. Why did we have to find that? And the old covenant was absolutely in tatters, because they could not, would not, did not keep the law until they forgot it altogether, didn't even know what it was. So there was no longer any agreement. So there had to be a new one if there was going to be one at all. And this is it. And if anybody, whoever or whatever you are, if you want to have a relationship with God, it has to be on the terms of the new covenant. Because this is the only one that's in operation. And God is in a position to dictate the terms, and you and I are not in a condition to dispute them. You see, you need him because he gives you air to breathe and you don't work very well without it. So he's in a position to tell you, and you're not in a position to argue. You need him because he keeps all your molecules hanging together. There's quite a lot of them. If you drank a cup of coffee, and the cups of coffee, the average size over there is about 18,000 million, million, million molecules of water in one of those cups of coffee. That's a lot. Fortunately for you, they all hang together and work properly. Otherwise, your little body would be in chaos, wouldn't it? Why do they all work for him? Because he makes it. You need him, and he doesn't need you. So he's in a position to dictate, and he has done. And this is it. And if you want any kind of relationship with God, it's got to be on the terms of the new covenant. And the new covenant is actually experienced the opposite way around to the way it's written. So you come into it at the last line and finally get to what God was aiming for when you get back to the first line. So we'll just work our way nice and systematically through it. And the last line says this, I will remember their sins no more. Now what on earth does that mean? I will remember their sins no more. Does God remember or does God forget? I forget. I'm actually very good at forgetting. I'm good at two things. The other one's sleeping. I'm good at sleeping and even better at forgetting. But I like to think that God is more reliable than I am. Otherwise, we're all in trouble, aren't we? So what does it mean when he says, I will remember their sins no more? Somebody once gave me a very good piece of advice that I found helpful on many, many occasions, and that's this. If the Bible uses a word and you don't know how it's being used and it doesn't altogether make sense to you, find out the first time the Bible uses that word. And the first time the Bible uses that word will probably explain to you what it means. So I did that with this word, remember. And you know, the first person ever to remember anything was God. And it happened back in the days of Noah. Now, you've heard of Noah, haven't you? And you remember that he built a rather unusual kind of a boat with an even more unusual crew. Do you remember how many floors it had? Three. Very good. How many doors? One. How many windows? One. Wonderful. If you're very good at arithmetic, you already know, don't you, that there was at least one floor that had neither a door nor a window. Isn't that right? Do you know how long they were in there? Just a little bit longer than a year. That's a long time to be in an ark, isn't it? Especially when you think of the company. And the atmosphere was definitely interesting in that one floor with neither a door nor a window. And after a little bit longer than a year, do you know what happened? God remembered Noah. Well, it was about time, wasn't it? What does that mean? That God suddenly woke up one morning and said, Noah, better get him out of there before it sinks. Those elephants have been busy. Don't think that's what it means. Because I don't think that God had forgotten him, do you? Well, if he hadn't forgotten him, how could he remember him? See, when God remembers something, he doesn't call back to mind something that he'd forgotten. When God remembers something, it simply means he takes action. The time has come to do something, according to God's very precise, very accurate timetable. And so when God remembered Noah, he did something about him, brought him out of the ark. Get the same thing with Abram. When he was 75, God promised him a son. And when he was 99, God remembered his promise and Sarah conceived. So when God remembers something, he takes action, right? And when God remembers your sin, what does that mean? It means he takes action concerning your sin. And God does take action concerning your sin. God takes action concerning every sin. And there is not one sin about which God does not take action. Every single sin, God takes action concerning that sin. I have friends in Australia who used to have a sheep farm. And it was way, way out in the back of beyond. And there was a little track that went for miles and miles till it got to their little sheep farm. And then it stopped because there was really nowhere else to go. And it was the only track that led to their farm. And they heard that there was a bushfire 300 miles wide burning up toward their farm. And the road ran back through the fire. There was no way they could drive down there. No other direction they could drive. No other road. Nowhere for an aircraft to land. No helicopters. They really thought they'd had it. And then the father had a bright idea, went to the garage, put a drum of paraffin or kerosene on the back of the pickup, drove it parallel to the advancing fire with a tap open, left a little slick of paraffin about a quarter of a mile long, set fire to it. And a new little fire, quarter of a mile wide, began to burn forward on the wind. They went to their home, got some drums of water and some food and provisions, packed them all up, and then they started to follow right down the middle of that little quarter of a mile strip where that little fire had just burned. And they followed the fire right down the middle of that strip. And then the main fire came roaring up 300 miles wide, hit that little strip, couldn't burn it again. So it divided round there, roared on till it caught up with the original, with the other little fire, and then raced on till it burned out on the edge of the desert. And they were safe because they were on that little strip of ground that was already burned. And the fire couldn't burn the same place twice. And that's what it means when you give yourself to Jesus Christ. Because when Jesus hung on the cross, the fire of the judgment of God fell on him. And when you hand yourself over to his keeping, God says about you, I will remember your sin no more. I will do nothing else about your sin because I've already done everything I intend to do about it to the person of my son. He has borne your punishment. And that's where you come in to the new covenant when you surrender your life into the keeping of Jesus Christ and God says to you, I will remember your sin no more. The next line up says this, I will forgive their wickedness. And forgiveness does not mean not punishing. It's quite a different word. It's a very beautiful word. Several of us here are husbands. And those of us who are husbands know all about forgiveness because we have to practice it all the time. It's one of those qualities that a husband will always need. And so I'm forever saying to my wife when I'm at home, I forgive you. It's all right. Don't worry about it. I forgive you. And I say it very often. But supposing she does something unusually bad, even for her. See? And in my usual gracious way, I say, it's all right. I forgive you. And then the next major battle comes round. See? Little skirmishes are fairly frequent in marriage. Major battles about every 2 years or so. You have to get your strength up for those. So the next major battle comes round. Now, what happens about that terrible thing that she did? I remember it. I don't only remember it, I wait for exactly the right moment, choose my words with the greatest care, and let her have it with both barrels right between the eyeballs. Now, why do I do that? Because I never forgave it. I said the word, but I didn't do it. Because had I forgiven it, then whatever it was she'd done could never again affect the relationship between us. If I'd really forgiven it, then I would behave to her, treat her, feel towards her as though she'd never done it. Forgiveness is a total restoration of the relationship. And God says, I will forgive their wickedness. So God isn't sitting up there grinding his teeth, looking down at you, scowling, thinking to himself, I can't punish the wretch because I've gone and said I wouldn't. Well, I wish I could. Look at their misery. He's not like that at all. He's forgiven you. And you are accepted in the Beloved. That means that you are as welcome in his presence as Jesus Christ himself. Then it says this, no longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. A couple of years ago, I went to a very important city by name of Liverpool. Liverpool being the soccer capital of the world. There are a few little places like Munich and Buenos Aires that try and dispute that from time to time. But without doubt, Liverpool is the soccer capital of the world. And I went there to hold a week of meetings. And I arrived there on Sunday morning, went to the church where I was to preach, and afterwards was introduced to a family with whom I was to stay. They had a small boy called Johnny, who was 9 years old, a fanatical supporter of Liverpool Football Club, a fanatical unsupporter of church, Sunday school, all things religious in general, and preachers in particular. And the worst news he'd ever heard was that a preacher was coming to stay in his home for a week. And when I met the family, his mother said to him, "Johnny, this is Mr. Needham. Shake hands with Mr. Needham." Johnny glared at me and said, "Why?" His mother couldn't think of a good reason, so he didn't. And that was all he said all day. And we were not getting on well. Monday he didn't speak either. Tuesday, however, I noticed out of the corner of my eye that when I told a joke to his parents at the meal table, Johnny actually smiled. And I thought, hey, we've made contact here. And sure enough, he actually spoke to me on the following day, and then we got around to playing together. And on the Friday, he came into the room where I was writing, stood looking at me for a bit, went out, came back again, and I saw that he had in his hand a little red book. So I went on writing for a minute, and then I said, "Well, are you going to show it to me?" And he put it down on the desk in front of me, and I saw that it was an autographed book. Now, I didn't touch it, but I just said, "Wow, I bet you've got somebody really special in there." And he still didn't say anything, but he just nodded very vigorously. So I said, "Well, are you going to show me who it is?" And he turned to a particular page that was just covered in mud. But if you looked underneath the mud, it said this: Kevin Keegan. Now, that will not mean much to a lot of you, but Kevin Keegan used to be the captain of England's national soccer team. He was also elected soccer player of the year for the whole of Europe by the other players. And he used to play for Liverpool. And Johnny told me how he came across that signature. He went to the ground 4 hours before a routine game was due to start. He got right at the front of the line, stood there for 3 hours, until the ground was open, paid his money, sprinted across the terraces, right down to the front, right next to a tunnel covered in wire netting, from whence the players come up out of the dressing room and onto the field. He waited to the end of the game. At the end of the game, sneaked one little hand in through the wire netting, and with the other one he pushed round his autograph book and his ballpoint pen, and he waited. When Keegan came off the field, he pushed it right in Keegan's face. And Keegan, rather than losing an eye on the ballpoint pen, stopped right there, grabbed the book, and wrote, "Kevin Keegan." He didn't put to Johnny from Kevin Keegan, because he didn't know it was Johnny's book. He didn't know Johnny had given it to him. He didn't even see Johnny's face, just a little hand. He didn't even put best wishes from Kevin Keegan. He just put Kevin Keegan. Now, who's Kevin Keegan anyway? Most of you had never heard of him, because Canada isn't all that cultured after all. But we're not talking about Kevin Keegan. We're talking about the God of Sinai, of the barricades and the dense cloud and the 2 days washing. And don't come near me, I'm holy. We're talking about the God of the galaxies and the constellations. And we're not talking about having his autograph or even his book. But he says this: "They shall all know me." And that word "know" is a very, very personal word. Adam knew his wife. And she conceived and bore a son. And God says, they shall all know me from the least to the greatest. Hey, isn't that nice? See, if you and I were writing it, we would say, they'll all know me from the greatest to the least. And we start with the prime minister, and we'd start with the stars of athletics and of show business and the millionaires, etc. And then we might get round to people like you and me. But God doesn't start that way around at all. He says, they'll all know me, beginning with the very least, and even the greatest will not be excluded as long as they don't let their greatness get in the way. They'll all know me. And then he says this, they will be my people. Isn't it nice to belong to somebody? One of the sad things about our times are people who do not belong to anybody. People who live in isolation are just lonely. Sometimes old people live alone. They die, nobody even knows they've died. Don't belong to anyone. First person to find out isn't a relative or someone who cares for them, it's someone to whom they owe money. $13 million refugees in the world at the moment. They don't belong. Nobody wants them. That's why they're refugees. If we wanted them, they wouldn't be refugees, would they? They don't belong. It's very sad when somebody does not belong, and it's great to know where you belong. And it's terrific to know that you belong to God. He says, they should be my people. They'll belong to me. They'll have a real place and a real significance in this big black universe. And they'll be important because they'll be important to me, the owner of the universe. But while it's great to belong to someone, there comes with it a responsibility. Suppose that our good friend and conference director, Mr. Wally Baker, realized on reflection that he does not get the kind of high esteem, regard, respect and reverence that a man of his singular abilities, talents and distinguished character deserves from you lot. And so he thinks about that and thinks, I've got to do something to impress these people with my importance. And so they've realized what a fine fellow I actually am. And having thought it over, he realizes that what he actually needs is some kind of status symbol. Status, if you must. Status is more impressive, since that's what we want, that's what we'll have. And when he thinks it through, of course, the one thing that really impresses people, apparently, is the right kind of car. So having thought about that, he realizes that there's really only one model that's adequate, and that's a Rolls Royce. So he calls up the nearest stockist of the Rolls Royce, finds out that you can now get an average Rolls for about $200,000 Canadian. And he doesn't want a flashy model, you understand, just an average one. So he then gets in touch with his bank manager to see whether he has $200,000 in his bank. He doesn't, in fact. So he saves his salary for a couple of weeks and then orders one. And when you order a Rolls Royce, of course you don't have to go and fetch it, they deliver it for you. So a Rolls Royce is delivered to the Baker home, actually on Saturday night. And he sees something really significant in that. He's a very spiritual man. So he decides that he's going to keep the Rolls Royce there until Sunday morning, when he'll make his first journey in it, all the way from home to the chapel, park it just there with the doors open so we can all see him arrive. And then we'll see the distinguished arrival, recognize what an important gentleman he really is, and give him the credit that he deserves. And he won't go joyriding in it on the Saturday night, so he doesn't. possesses himself in patience, tries to sleep. Sunday morning leaves things as late as possible. There's no point in arriving here before we get here. Otherwise we won't see him come. So he leaves it a little later than usual. Finally the time comes and he sets out, opens the door, steps outside and it's not there. Sue has come in it. Ladies have rights over here in Canada. And so there it is, parked outside the front door, and Sue has arrived in it. So, of course, Wally is very gracious and forgiving and jumps on his bike and pedals across here. Forgives her. Just locks her in the office at the back there to make sure she doesn't do it again. And thinks to himself, well, I can drive home in it when the meeting's over and everyone will see me drive away in it. That's just as good, isn't it? Except when the meeting's over, it's not there. Pastor Crook, Rook, has he's always wanted to drive a Rolls Royce. And he's gone. Not sure where he's going, but he's gone. And Sunday evening, it's Ruth Stevenson that borrows it. And then after the meeting, Heather's away in it. And everybody's driving it, except Wally. 2 years go by and he's still not sat in it. Highly spiritual man though he is, he's just beginning to get slightly irritated. Sits down one day and says to himself, now how much did I spend on that thing? $200,000. Does that not mean it's mine? If it's mine, why are all these other people driving it? And why do I not get to use it? And you say, this is more stupid than your stories really are, Mr. Needham. I hope this is going somewhere. And I know it is rather stupid. Except, didn't somebody pay more than that for you? Isn't it true that the Lord Jesus Christ paid his life's blood for you? That's what it means to be redeemed. And if he bought you, doesn't that not mean you belong to him? And do you suppose it's possible that once in a while he has come to you wanting to use the life that he bought, but he wasn't able to because you were not available? You were off doing something for somebody else, or off doing something for yourself, or any old crazy thing except to be there available for the one to whom you rightly belong. See, the Corinthians never even understood that they did belong. And Paul had to write to them and say, hey, don't you know? You have been bought with a price. You are not your own. So glorify God in your body and in your spirit because they are his. See, I meet people who really think that they do God a favor because they give him an hour a week. If you give God an hour a week, you steal 167 hours. Because they all belong to him, because you belong to him. There is a responsibility in belonging. You've been bought, and you're not your own. It's great to belong, to know that you're his, but if you're his, then you're his. Live as though you were his, not as though you were your own. And don't flatter yourself and once in a while you get round to obeying. Actually giving him what belongs to him. You're his twice, as a matter of fact. First, because he made you, and second, having made you, he had to come and buy you because you sold yourself into sin. They will be my people, he says. And then he says this, I will be their God. Hey, it starts getting exciting now. I will be their God. What does that mean? Being God means all kinds of things. It means, for instance, authority. Being God means authority. And I learned about authority when I was in the army. Told you I was in the army, didn't I? That just having graduated in science, I got this invitation from the Queen to go in her army. Apparently she needed me and would feel much more relaxed if she knew I was in. So I went in, and the first creature I met was a gorilla with a massive chest, huge pair of lungs, powerful voice, three stripes on his arm, and an IQ of about 5. And he had the responsibility of turning this rabble of new recruits into an army. See? And he had various ways of doing it. One of them was to get us all dressed up in our army uniform. Horrible heavy boots. Horrible hairy uniforms. Even hairier muddy coloured shirts. Horrible heavy rifle weighed 9 pounds. Had to carry it everywhere. They never gave you any bullets unless you had fun. Shot the gorilla or something. And he'd get us out in this enormous concrete square. And we'd start off on one side and he would shout, "Quick, march!" And we would march all the way over to the far side. And then he would shout, "About, turn!" And we'd turn around and go all the way back to where we started. And then he would shout, "About, turn!" And we'd turn around and we'd set off all over again. And I would be muttering to myself, "You stupid ape. Would you think first, decide whether you want us this side or that side, and then shout?" And I was really not getting on well with these procedures when one night as we were polishing our boots and brasses, in came a captain looking for somebody called Needham. I thought, shall I say it's me or shall I hide under the bed? I was just trying to decide when he said, "You're Needham." And I said, "Oh, yes, sir. Excuse me." I just got used to being a number. I'd forgotten I had a name as well. And I said, "Right, tomorrow morning you will not go on the parade ground. According to your record, you used to work backstage in the theatre when you're in high school. So tomorrow morning you'll report to the camp theatre and you'll service all the equipment backstage." I said, "Yes, sir." And I thought, I could just do with a day off from the parade ground. Sounds all right. So the next morning, as the others went out on parade, I was in this little room at the back of the theatre, my horrible hairy shirt open, my horrible heavy boots off, horrible heavy rifle thrown in a corner, mug of tea on the table with a soldier detailed to come fill it up every half hour, music playing in the background, 2 bits of wire in one hand, soldering iron in the other hand, thinking to myself, I can make this last the whole 2 years. Army life is not so bad after all. When in came the gorilla. And he was upset. I could tell that he was upset. And he said, "What are you doing in here? Get out there on the parade ground this instant." And I gave him my nicest smile. And I said, "Good morning, Sergeant. How nice to see you. Would you like to check that with Captain Black first? I would hate to get you into trouble." Turned around, stomped out, gave a huge snort, slammed the door, which I expect is still loose on its hinges, and I heard his delightful voice taking out his rage on the rest of the troops out on the square. And I sat there, looking at my soldering iron, musing, thinking to myself, isn't it good to be under authority? You see, if I'd just done that off my own initiative, I would have been peeling potatoes till now. But because I did it under the instructions of a captain, there was no way a mere sergeant could lay a finger on me. It was great. Now, have you learned to live that way with God? Seriously. So that he's the authority, he gives the instructions, and you just do as you're told. Because when he gives the instructions and you just do as you're told, he assumes the responsibility and you don't have to live with it.